First case is 96-285, State of Ohio versus John Jeffrey Ely. Ms. Cerny, I'm sorry, Ms. Fruca.
Then he pointed the gun at the individual who pulled the trigger. I mean, he intended to do all of that, did he not?
Correct, but the statute requires a felony murder, two things. It requires under subsection B that no person shall purposely cause the death of another while committing aggravated robbery. And I think the actions that he engaged in here demonstrate, go towards the demonstration of the purposeful action with regard to committing a robbery which resulted in the death of the victim. But the aggravated murder statute also has subsection D, which says that the defendant must be specifically found to have intended to cause the death of the victim. And I think the unusual thing about this case is that we have something on the record which is undisputed by any other evidence that the state presented, that he was trying to nearly hit him in the shoulder.
Well, I mean, wouldn't that be almost the perfect defense to every death penalty? Would there be anything left of the death penalty if we bought into the theory that you're advancing? Nobody ever intended to cause it. They meant to hurt him, meant to wound him, meant to incapacitate them, whatever, but they sure didn't mean to kill them. I mean, what can you imagine a conviction if we wrote what you're urging us to write in this case?
Well, first of all, the statute doesn't require the specific intent. The statute also requires that the non-consistent inference, if there should be any instruction about the inference, or the behavior or the use of the weapon, what they intended, that the defendant be entitled to present evidence to the prior effect. Has to consider any evidence that rebuts that sort of presumption. The state has to prove the specific intent beyond a reasonable doubt. In other cases,
so you feel with these facts presented, the jury could not come to any other conclusion than that your client did not intend to
reach Japan?
She has a
The trial facts.
I think, and I think in other cases, there's been more evidence where the fish has come up with a specific intent of the defendant. There's been additional evidence, the court has looked at circumstantial evidence that I think that the just recently in the case that the court looked at some of the evidence around the prior relationship of the defendant. That should be the defendant provided the weapon and information for others to kill and could make that further step towards concluding that he had to put the intent to kill the victim. And in this case, we don't have any other circumstantial evidence to review what he said in his statement. And,
well, certainly circumstantial evidence would be the fact that he pointed the gun, he shot the defendant, it didn't, the victim, it didn't enter his shoulder, it entered his head. I mean, it was, the three-judge panel certainly would be within their right to reject his self-serving statement of intent and find from the factual evidence that existed that he intended to actually kill him.
I don't think that the statement is self-serving in this case, and the reason for that is some of the issues that we raised about the admissibility of the confession, and although it's incontradictory, I'm going to argue that the statement is admissible, and then either on the other hand, the fact that the confession made it consistent, reliable, is the position that he was in at the time he made the statement. He was taking some of his medication for a period of time, drinking, not eating very much, and not that much sleep. He was interrogated at night about an hour after. We also have testimony from a psychologist that had very limited educational background and limited intelligence, and that he really did not know what's incriminating and what's not incriminating. And I think based on that, he really wouldn't have had the ability to calculate the statement to put in some facts saying, well, this is going to be somewhere down the road. I'll say I just shot him in the shoulder. There's some facts surrounding his confession that lend it a degree of reliability and that I think we can conclude that it wasn't very self-serving on his part, which is
You argue limited capacity, but my 10-year-old child can sure pick up in 2 seconds an excuse for something that he deliberately did once he's caught at it, and I certainly think that the three-judge panel has the ability to judge all of that to come to a different conclusion as well, don't you think?
Again, I think all of the facts I've already said about the statements and the fact that one of the police officers testified that he thought it was very unusual for the defendant would come in and not blame the other person for the shooting. That he would come in and admit that he did the shooting, but that he didn't intend to do it, I think adds an extra degree of reliability to the statement. He could have done a number of other things in the statement. He could have blamed Elton Green completely for the crime. He was consistent in his remarks, and there's really nothing else that the state presented to dispute what he said.
Can't the sense be inferred from the use of a deadly weapon in the area where the wound is on the body and the head? Any
inference would have to be non-conclusive, and as the statute would
statements contained in these confessions of the police.
Is it
you said it's refuted by the statements of the defendant. I just wondered where that came from.
Yes, any inference that he specifically intended to kill the victim is refuted by his statement that he shot at the shoulder. And also the fact that the shooting didn't occur until Elton Green entered the store. Johnny Lee said, this is a robbery, I don't want to hurt you. That's all consistent with his statement that he didn't intend to actually kill the victim.
Did this defendant testify in the Melvin Green case?
No.
If all that we're being asked to consider, in effect, in mitigation, or at least with regard to his confession, is so, why would he have not testified and said those things under oath?
I don't know why he didn't testify. That's not on the record.
Was he called in that case?
There was a newspaper clipping submitted by the defense about Melvin Green's case, and what it said was the prosecutor had made statements to the press that the death penalty specification was added to John Healy's case because they wanted him to testify against Melvin Green.
Okay, so the answer to my question is we really don't know.
Right.
Okay. Getting back to your argument that the use of a deadly weapon does not, in and of itself, during the course of an aggravated robbery, allow a jury to find a purposeful intent to kill. That's been a long line of Ohio Supreme Court cases. Can you cite one case that we have not so held? Are there any Ohio Supreme Court cases where a deadly weapon has been used during the course of an aggravated robbery that's resulted in a death that we have not found that to be sufficient to show a purposeful intent to kill? My point is you're asking us to leave that long line of cases, and is that correct?
I don't know if this is inconsistent with those cases in the respect that this case is so unusual in that we have very, very good evidence against the appellant. And it's where there's only his statement and his statement.
Well, we do have circumstantial evidence. We do know that the plan was an aggravated robbery, and we do know that a deadly weapon was used, a gun was used. What is so little evidence about that?
the state is saying that he did not intend to kill the victim, and that is the fact and evidence, and that is the presumption.
Well, maybe that goes to prior calculation design, but does it defeat the specification?
Well, this argument really goes to the aggravated murder charge. I don't think that that was a valid charge, and he doesn't have the aggravated murder charge, so there really can't be any specification. It really goes to the requirement of the aggravated murder statute saying that the BS has a specific intent to kill, in addition to the purposeful action required by the felony murder subsection. And then once we get past that, then the definitely specification requires an additional behavior of either being the principal offender or acting in prior calculation.
But there's no question here, he's the principal offender. Is that correct? Okay, so if you're defeating the prior calculation design requirement, it still leaves us with a proper specification given the armed robbery, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't leave us with a proper aggravated murder conviction.
I understand your argument with regard to that because you say you didn't have the purpose to kill. So then what we need to say is that if you point a gun at somebody and pull the trigger, all we need to say is, just as Piper suggests, I didn't mean to do it. I only meant to hurt him, I didn't mean to kill him. And that would be an absolute defense if we wrote that, wouldn't it?
No, because the court would still, and the prior effect, you still have to look at all the surrounding circumstances, and there's probably going to be other evidence to support or refute what the defense says. And the court has said that the specific intent is akin to an essential element of the offense. If the state fails to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, there can be no conviction for aggravated murder. We ask that this court, in this case, make a conviction for aggravated murder.
Thank you, Ms. Fruca. Ms. Cerny.
Good morning, Your Honor. Needless to say, the state does rely on the wrong line of cases that the court has previously, indicating specifically that intent can be presumed more than after the probable consequences of an act to be death. And such intent may be deduced from the circumstances, from the situation of youth, and its tendency to destroy life is due to that purpose. That was in Robinson. Also, where an inherently dangerous instrumentality is used, a homicide during the commission of that felony is a natural and probable consequence, presumed to have been intended to act in the part. Even though Mr. Ely has claimed that we didn't mean to kill him, we meant to shoot him in the shoulder, even a wound in the shoulder could conceivably have resulted in his death. So, whether you're aiming for a shoulder, or aiming for a head, or aiming in the part of the body, you can still have that shot result in death, and therefore, using a gun, which is a dangerous instrumentality, the intent to kill him so he pursued. I don't believe that any of the arguments clearly refute that that's not what John Ely intended to do. We're speculating as to what his intentions are. There's a lot of claim that he had limited intelligence, but yet the psychologist clearly indicated that John Ely was not suffering from any mental disorder in any way. He was not suffering at the time of the commission of crime from an alcohol or drug-induced lack. There's no testimony as to real diminished capacity on his part. Therefore, the state contends that he really has to be held responsible for his actions. The
Was Green found guilty of something?
No, he was acquitted, Your Honor, because there wasn't evidence sufficient to convict him.
Was he tried by a jury? Or was it a jury?
Your Honor, I can't recall precisely right now. I'm sorry. But I do know that he was acquitted in the matter because there wasn't sufficient evidence to find him culpable of an aggravated murder.
Counsel, I've been trying to find out the answer to this ever since I picked up this case. Maybe you can furnish the answer formally to me. I'm really interested in what happened to the case between July 27, 1987, when the three-judge panel filed its opinion, and December 20, 1995, when the Court of Appeals filed its opinion. As I calculated, between those two opinions comes 8 years, 4 months, and 23 days. And for the life of me, in reading all of the briefs, in reading all the material I had in the folder, not one person thought that to be unusual, and I could not find any reason whatsoever for the 8 years away. Now, maybe you have the answer.
Well, the only answer I have, Your Honor, is that initially, the case was appealed to the 7th District Court of Appeals. There was some leads taken on both sides, and then I do know that, in fact, the Court of Appeals did not, I honestly cannot tell you when oral arguments were held even in the Court of Appeals, but the decision was rendered quite some time after oral arguments actually took place in the Court of Appeals. So where was the case? The case was basically pending before the Court of Appeals and all that time. There is leads taken by both sides. I don't have the exact number of leads taken by either party, Your Honor.
So the answer is the language in the Court of Appeals for 8 years.
That is it, Your Honor.
What would be so complicated as to even require a great number of leaves on this case?
Again, Your Honor, I'm really unable to say because I wasn't involved in the case, so I can't even tell you from personal knowledge. I wasn't the prosecutor that actually argued the case in court.
This is certainly not the most complex death penalty case either of side has had to present on appeal.
And I don't know why. I honestly, that answer I don't have. Why it stayed up there so long?
It is the prosecutor's job to keep it moving, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor, but once, and I did have my brief with me, but I left it, I don't have it here, and I could tell you the date that the brief that means the prosecutor's brief was filed in the Court of Appeals.
Well, the record will show all of the continuances and requests of defense and prosecution, et cetera.
And I can let you know exactly when you were filed. But with regard, do you have any specific questions with regard to the intent or from the state standpoint? Or any of the other signs of error that were raised that explained to the court?
Do you know why the defendant didn't testify at Mr. Green's trial? Because all our briefs say is that Mr. Green was acquitted of the aggravated murder charge. Was he convicted of something?
No, he was not convicted, but he was acquitted and he went free. He went free. Yes, he did.
After telling the police that the defendant had done it.
I don't have a document that says anything, but I understood that Mr. Ewing did not wish to testify against him. Therefore, without Mr. Green's testimony, there was no case against Mr. Green. But I don't have any documents that Mr. Ewing refused to testify.
You didn't have any evidence evidence against Mr. Green. He testified he was there. He went into the store afterwards. They split the money.
That's what Mr. Ely said in his statement, Your Honor. But that statement wasn't introduced.
But what about the eyewitnesses after the event? There were, what, two, three?
Green was the only one identified as being
there. Exactly. But nobody actually placing him in the store at the time of the killing. That's my understanding. That there was the only one in the store at the time of the killing was John Ely. And without that, the prosecution had no case and he was acquitted.
Thank you, Ms. Cerny. Ms. Pruka, you've saved 12 minutes of your time.
The state went over again, I think, some of the things I already covered in my article,
so he waived a jury and was just tried to the court.
Also, Green was in the store at the time of the killing. I think he stated that he wasn't there at the time of the killing, but he was in the store. And as I said earlier, that it was his coming to the store that apparently precipitated the shooting of the victim.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.